All right, welcome to Talk Jiu-Jitsu with host Uki Mike, Joey Boreski, and me, Jordan Pressinger from Jordan Teaches Jiu-Jitsu. Today we have a great episode for you guys, and what we're not going to do is talk about the ecological approach. We'll save that for a future episode, but I do find that stuff very interesting, and I've been learning a lot about it. But what we do want to talk about is ADCC West Coast Trials. Some interesting things happened there, and what I want to start off with, though, is just talking about that street fight where the guy broke the other guy's arm. And it was pretty interesting. Like, Mike didn't see the video. We tried to find it to show him, but couldn't find it. But basically, I'll give you guys the gist of it. This guy was approaching this jiu-jitsu guy wanting to fight, and then the jiu-jitsu guy took him down very easily, mounted him very easily, and then broke his arm with an arm bar very easily, and his arm's like flopping around. Then he gets on top, starts elbowing him and stuff like that. But like, the guy he was fighting was like drunk and had nothing for him. Like, it was just like a total beatdown. And I think it definitely crossed the line of like self-defense, and it was basically assault. Like, I think that like it can be justified to break someone's arm in a fight, but it depends. Like, if you're really at risk of getting hurt, someone trying to kill you or whatever, like, you got to do what you got to do. But for this guy specifically, like, he wasn't much of a threat. It was just this like drunk, unathletic, like, guy. Like, it was just too easy for him. So like, why break the dude's arm and like, you know, permanently screw up his arm? Like, it just makes no sense to me. Like, what do you guys think? Do you think there's a time and a place to break someone's arm, or do you think it's just like, whatever, you know? Because people on Reddit, they're like, or and Gordon too, he's like, you're crazy if you think that's not justified. Like, you should be able to, you got to do what you got to do. But he didn't have to do that. So what do you guys think?
I think you have to take it case by case. If your life's in danger and you have to break a bone, then you have to do it. But I mean, excessive force is excessive force. Like you said, he kept pounding on the guy after he was already subdued, right? So
yeah, why not just mount him and control him, you know? And like, what do you think, Joey, is the best thing to do in a street fight, like using your jiu-jitsu? Like, I think probably it's take the back and ideally put them in the straitjacket, and they really can't do anything. Because certain positions, like, you can control them, but they might be able to like pull out a knife or something, stab you or bite you or something like that. But other positions, like, you're good to go. Like, what do you think, Joey's the best position?
I have like two opinions. One, I think it depends on how you want the fight to end. So if your plan is to like have the police show up and arrest the guy, then yeah, take the back, straight jacket the guy. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to hurt him. You can hold him. Law enforcement can arrive, arrest him, do whatever you have to do. But if this is a scenario where you're like, I'm just going to get up and leave when this is done, I'm breaking that dude's arm for sure. I wouldn't stop at just breaking the arm. I would make sure it's really broken, make sure it's unusable. Because when you get up and turn around, if you don't break the guy's arm, he might say, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good. You get up and he punches you in the back of the head. If I'm actually using jiu-jitsu for self-defense, I want to use it in that way. When I get up, you are no longer a threat to me and I can just leave. I don't have to engage. I don't have to watch out. You're just not going to hit me anymore. So like, in that sense, I think like a Kimura, an arm bar, both of those are great. That arm's not useful anymore. I don't have to worry about you hitting me. I can leave this altercation now. Or honestly, even something like, I don't know how it would apply to a street fight. I probably wouldn't want to do this because it might get hit in the head. But like, if you heel hook someone and break their knee, that guy's probably not going to get up and chase you afterwards. So like, I'm probably pretty safe to leave.
That's true. But like, what if you're fighting someone that's actually pretty low threat? They're like, just this like drunken, like, you know, not strong, not like, they don't know what they're doing. Cause this guy, he looked like a black belt rolling with a brand new white belt that was just awful. Like, it was just like too easy for the guy. So like, in that case, do you think he still should have broke his arm?
I would, like, personally in that situation, I would, cause you never know what someone's capable of, especially like when you get up and that altercation's done. Like, even a guy who's maybe not threatening, like, maybe he hits really hard. I don't know. Maybe he's going to hit me in the back of the head. That's not the safest place to be hit. Things can happen. Like, for me, I'm obviously not going to go around and just fight random drunk dudes. Typically, that's not how I like to spend my weekends and evenings. Now, if there's some random drunk dudes who want to fight, like, hey, shoot me a message. We can have some fun. But yeah, like, that's kind of not the lifestyle I live. But if I'm ever in a situation where I feel like I actually physically need to defend myself, I'm going to make sure I defend myself well, and that this guy's not just going to get up and I'm going to have to go through this whole process of like take down, you know, pin, whatever strangle again, and then he's going to get back up and we're going to do it all over again. Because every time you get back up and have to go back down, things can go wrong. You could slip, someone could land a punch. I want to make sure if I'm defending myself, it's quick, it's easy, it's done, and you're not a threat to me anymore.
Yeah, that's true for sure. I think it's situational. Like, I think at least, and one thing that's the wrong, like the one problem with chokes, like a choke is a great thing to do to someone in a street fight in practically, but then the problem is that it can be attempted murder, you know, it'd be like in the eyes of like the, I don't know, the prosecutor or whatever. Right. So like, that can put you at a lot of risk. And if you're choking someone, other people around might think you're actually trying to kill them. And then, you know, they might like do things to you that aren't good. So like, even though it like realistically, that's the best way to end a fight, it can be not a great idea afterwards. So I think maybe that should be more like, I don't know, more okay. This should be okay to choke someone in a street fight, and you don't have to worry about attempted murder charges, because it's like, no, I'm just trying to, you know, put them to sleep, and then that's it. And then, you know, I can walk away.
There was that video of that guy on a subway who put a guy to sleep. I think he was ex-military, ex-Marine or something like that. And correct me if I'm wrong, but, and they, killed him. The guy ended up dying.
Yeah. It's like, bro, why are you holding on, on so long?
Yeah. I mean, it looked like he sort of knew what he was doing, kind of, maybe watched UFC or something like that, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think that guy was just a little too excited. You know, he just, I don't know. Like, it's like you have to hold a long time to kill somebody unless they have like, you know, pre-existing conditions. Yeah, which is definitely something to worry about too. Because if you kill someone, that's not good.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons. One, it's just not a nice thing to do to somebody, you know, kill them. But also, you know, you could go to jail for that and all over, like what, you know, because that's the thing with fights. Like, I always think like these people could probably be friends like in another circumstance, you know, but like in this specific circumstance, they're like, you know, fighting, hate each other, but you know, they don't even know each other. So like to go to jail for that forever or for a long time because some guy you had a disagreement with, like, I don't know, just like, you don't want to ruin your life.
And you never know what can happen. I was a tattoo artist for about 25 years and I've heard tons of stories. I've tattooed lots of bouncers and I tattooed this one guy and he shoved a guy. And the guy landed and hit his head on the cement and died. And he ended up spending 18 months in jail and like 5 years house arrest or something like that. But I mean, it can happen in just a split second. You could kill somebody by accident.
Yeah. And that's what makes me cringe the most when I watch like street fights or whatever, like online. I don't sound like I watch street fights in person. I would if they were around. There's not happening all the time here.
Pretty safe up here in Canada.
Yeah, especially where we are in a small town. But like when I see someone, you know, a punch lands on them and then they get knocked out and they fall back, hit their head on the cement.
Yeah,
that is like, oh, that's very hard for me to watch. Like, yeah, I hate seeing people hit their head. Like that's not good.
Yeah, it's the worst part.
But yeah, we also want to talk about ADCC West Coast Trials. Something really interesting happened, which was, is it Alex Perez? Is that his name?
Mike Perez.
Yeah. So this 170 poundish guy, he fought in the 99 plus kilo division, which is like 220 pounds plus. And he won. He won first place. So he went up against these bigger dudes. And now he's going to be going to ADCC and like fighting guys like Gordon Ryan, which is pretty interesting, you know, as a smaller guy. But I think that was like smart because the heavyweight division is very top heavy. So like the guys that are good, like Gordon, they're really good. But then the guys that are, you know, doing trials, like they're not, I don't know, they're not that they're not good, but like usually big guys aren't that technical. And you can see that watching, just watching it. It's like, you know, they're not very fluid. The stuff they're doing, it's like, oh wow, that, you know, that's what you're doing. And yeah, you know, he won. And it was a smart decision because these other divisions, like his regular division, are like, there's good guys everywhere. Like there's tons of good guys. It's the same thing in the UFC where like the lightweight division, welterweight division is just packed with good guys. And then like heavyweight, just like a few. So yeah. But what did you think watching that, Joey?
First, I'm a little skeptical of like the claim people are starting to make where he's like, oh, he was 170 pounds. Like, I don't know, man. I watched the 170 pound division and then you look at him and you're like, okay, so like he's significantly bigger than them. You know, you watch the 190 pound division. And you're like, he's a little bigger than most of those guys, if not similar sized. I think it's one of those things where, like, he was definitely undersized for the division, but you know how things get. You're a little undersized, and all of a sudden people start exaggerating. Like, you know, next week he's going to be 160 pounds in the stories, and then he's going to be 150 pounds. And you're like, okay, you know, the truth is he's probably somewhere in the, like, 180 to 200 range, which is still impressive doing a 220 division. Again, I watched pretty much the entire event. I watched the finals. I don't think he won that. I think that was a really, really terrible judge's decision, especially based on the ADCC criteria as I've been explained it. And as it's been explained and used in, like, the tournaments and opens I've been to. So, like, I think there may have been a little bit of a bias in the decision there. It's like, you know, it's a very close match, but this guy's way smaller, so we should maybe give it to him because it's more impressive or something like that. Because using their actual metrics, I just don't see how he should have won that match. But other than that, yeah, I definitely agree. Like, plus 99 is typically one of the weaker divisions talent-wise. Not saying there's no good guys. Obviously, like, there's still a lot of talent in these divisions. It's ADCC trials. A lot of these guys are good. But, you know, you look at 77 kilograms or 66, and you have the rounds of 32, the rounds of 64, like, every guy who makes it that far is really good. The rounds of 64, I don't even know if they have 64 guys who do the plus 99. So yeah. It's one of those things where it's, if you're small and you're fast and you know you're capable of beating some of those guys, would you rather have to beat four or five world-class guys at 170 or maybe one or two at 220?
Yeah, exactly. And and watching that was kind of like inspirational for me because I think I have a very good style against big guys. And I was like, oh, like, maybe I could do ADCC trials at the heavyweight division too, because I think that I'd stand a better chance against those guys. I think, you know, I'd be confident in my own division, but, like, I think those guys are going to be easier. But, like, I don't know. This isn't a slight of Perez. This is more of just a question in general, like, because I'm impressed with what he did, but, like, is picking the easier division actually kind of cowardly in a sense when it appears more to be, like, courageous because it's going against bigger guys? Again, not against Perez. I'm just saying, just in general, like, picking an easier division. Like, what do you guys think about that?
For me, I'm always going to try and pick the division where I can get, like, the most matches and the most appropriate matches. I don't know if I would call it cowardly, but I definitely think it's tactical. I mean, if your goal is to make it to ADCC, I think it's smart, if you think you're capable of that, pick the one that you're going to have the easiest time with. I mean, there's a reason people cut weight. You're cutting to hit a division that you think will be easier given your size and strength, and not just fighting at what you naturally walk around at. So I guess it's some of that. I actually think, like you said, for you doing heavyweight, I actually think that's smart. Like, ADCC trials are a long, grueling tournament. And the big thing I took away from watching him at heavyweight is he still looked relatively fresh towards the finals. Like, he still seemed to have some energy, whereas, like, some of the other guys in the semifinals looked really tired. Like, they looked like it had been two long days of grappling and they were having a hard time. And then you watch, you know, 77 or 88 kilograms, and that is definitely not the case. Like, all these guys are fresh, still ready to go, even 5-6 matches in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, like, I think that, like, 190 pounds is, like, the perfect weight to be able to beat these guys, because, you know, usually you're faster, you're pretty strong, and, like, usually more technical too. Whereas, like, when you get smaller, it's going to be harder to match their strength as much. But, like, I feel like that's, like, the sweet spot, and that's where I'm at. So, yeah, maybe I'll do the heavyweight division. Like, I don't know, just in general, I always like competing against the big guys. Like, I think that's, like, I don't know, fun, and just going out there and looking at them, like, looking up, like, oh my God, they're huge. Like, this is what I have in front of me. But then when you start grappling, it's like, oh, like, it's not that, I wouldn't say hard, but it's not like, what I thought it was going to be. You know, like, every time I went out there, like, I've been worried, like, looking at these huge guys, but then it's like, you get comfortable pretty quick when you start feeling them, and they're like, oh, okay, they're a little bit slow. Okay. They're a little bit, not as technical. It's like, yeah, good to go.
I'm still purple belt. I have trouble with everybody. So big, small, doesn't matter to me. I just try to make it through the night.
Yeah, yeah. I saw DeAndre Korb, Greg's guy. He won first place. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, he did. He came first, and his brother actually came third. They fought in the semifinals, which is like, wow. That to me is kind of a funny one. Like, I can't imagine having to fight like your sibling in the semifinals of ADCC trials, knowing that only one of you is going to get a chance to actually go to the finals and the win, go to the main ADCC. So that was, you know, I think that's kind of one of those matches where you watched afterwards and you're like, ah, oh, that's got to feel really good to win and know you're going to the finals, but it's got to suck to know that you made it so your brother can't go.
Yeah, that would be pretty awkward, because it is good in the sense of like, okay, one of us is going to the finals, but it's only going to be one of us, you know? So that is, it'd be pretty awkward. I don't know. I'd have a hard time dealing with that personally if I had a brother who's competing in the same division. And yeah, that'd be tough. Are they twins too?
I don't think they're twins. They're a couple of years apart, but they've fought a bunch of times now. Like, I think at least 3 or 4 times in tournaments. Like for the opens and stuff, they usually try to separate their weight classes. I'd be curious down the road if maybe they, like, one of them moves up to 77 so that the other can, you know, have a chance. But I think DeAndre's won every time they've fought in a tournament. So I might be wrong. So if someone can correct me on that one, please do. But I think DeAndre's won pretty much every time. So, you know, might be nice for Gavin. Maybe he needs to bulk up, or maybe DeAndre needs to bulk up so they can both have a chance.
Yeah, they could go the Gordon Ryan approach and just bulk up very fast. Yeah.
Mysteriously.
Yeah. No supplements, you know, whatsoever, of course. No. Like, what's interesting, too, is one of the Rutolos, they said that they could beat Gordon if he was off steroids. And then Gordon, I don't know what he said, but he kind of lashed out at them. But I'd like to see that, you know. And it's like, why lash out at them? Why not just prove it? You know, just when you're off cycle, or just go off cycle, go compete against them and see how you do. I think that'd be very interesting. Like, who do you think would win? Like Rutolo, one of them, or a Natty Gordon?
That's actually a tough one. Because, like, we have seen Gordon compete when he wasn't giant. I mean, his first ADCC, I think he did, I want to say 88 kilograms, maybe. He's competed in the past at a smaller weight. He wasn't always big. Like, for people who don't know, Gordon used to be, like, a pretty normal-sized person. He wasn't massive.
Yeah, he was at like 170 pounds back when he was called the Iron Dragon when he fought for EBI, I think, the first time.
And he was still good. He was still a good grappler back then. Yeah. He beat some good guys. So, like, it's not like he doesn't have significant skills, and it's not like he doesn't know how to beat, you know, smaller guys or be smaller. My question would be, how much has whatever supplements, whatever substances he may have allegedly taken, affected his body? You know, like, when you take these things, like, I think a lot of people think steroids are just some sort of, like, you take it and all of a sudden you gain magical powers that never go away. And it's like, no, everything comes at a cost. I mean, a lot of these steroids that build a lot of muscle affect your cardiovascular endurance. Like, and again, this isn't like a massive criticism of Gordon, but one thing you'll notice in Gordon's matches is his pace is always extremely slow. Gordon's not someone who pushes the pace. You've got to wonder if a part of that's because, is it possible to be that size and push a pace for 20 minutes? Well, I know the Rutolos can push a pace for 20 minutes. They'll push you. They won't let you stop, man. Those little guys just keep going. So I think maybe that would be an area that you'd have to wonder, like, is Gordon going to be able to play at a pace that's comfortable for him? Can his cardio hang up with those guys who are going to be, you know, more aggressive and pushing the pace when he doesn't have the strength to control them and, you know, pin them the same way he would if he was on whatever supplements he may or may not be taking?
Yeah, like, I think he'd win, you know. I'm pretty sure Gordon would win, but I think it comes down to, like, who, like, what kind of match it becomes. If it is like a high paced match, which is like what the Rutolos would want, I say like it's both of them competing, but just one of them. So, like, if they can make it high paced, then that makes in their favor. But if Gordon can keep the pace slow and stop them from being so dynamic, and that's playing right into his game, I think that's where he'd be successful. I like to see it, though. I think Gordon will win. What do you think, Mike?
If I'm taking 170 pound Gordon from EBI and the Rutolos now, I'd pick one of the Rutolos to win.
Yeah, just a gut feeling.
Yep, just a gut feeling. I love their style, how explosive and crazy they are. They go 100% all the time. I love it.
Yeah, they do.
They're fun to watch. They're never a dull moment.
It's not that I think that they're not technical, but I think that they really rely on their chaotic nature.
Yeah, that's what I love to watch. Yeah,
it's fun to watch. A good guy to watch too, like Mika Galvao, because I started doing a video on him, but it's actually really hard to make a video on him because there's not really much to say. It's like, yeah, he's good. He's good everywhere. You know, it's a short video where I did one on Nicky Rod, and it was more like he has a very specific game plan, like get the body lock basically. And there's just more to say about how he does it and where he gets it from, what he does when he has it, what he does when he can't get it. But with Mika, it's like he's comfortable everywhere. He's good everywhere. What do I say? So he has a pretty chaotic style too, actually, like similar to the Rutolos, but it's like different at the same time because it's still very based in, like, he's very technical still. And it's not that they're not, but I feel like he has a more technical style while still being chaotic, where they're a little more chaotic for sure. And just an interesting thing to to watch and to kind of break down, because that can play such a part in jiu-jitsu too, because it's not just about how technical you are, being chaotic and just making it can make it really tough. Cause I find that's where I struggle either with someone's really, dynamic, or they're really slow, you know, where I'm pretty dynamic myself, but if they're super chaotic and just slow down, I don't have the cardio for this, you know, or if they're really slow and don't let me move, that's when I start to, run into more trouble. So styles matter so much. And,
I think you really nailed it. I like to watch a lot of footage and break it down. This is something I just really enjoy doing. It's a way to spend my time. And Mika's chaotic. He moves a lot, but when you watch his matches, I'm sure when you watch them, as a good grappler and good analyst, you can see where he's going with things. You're okay, he's moving a lot, he's chaotic, but I can kind of understand and interpret, I think I understand his thought process behind what he's doing here. Sometimes when I watch the Rutolos, it just it doesn't make any sense. I'm watching and I'm okay, it looks like he's going to do this. Oh, and he's just randomly done a cartwheel and a spin. And you're it just seems sometimes they're moving for the sake of moving. And I imagine that's hard to compete against, because me watching it, I have no idea what this guy's going to do next. I know he's going to do something, but I don't know what's coming. And I can't imagine the guys competing against him are oh, he's just started spinning or doing random motions. And then submissions come out of nowhere, because it's really hard to anticipate how these guys are going to move. They just move.
That's exactly it. And it's kind of similar, but not to a brand new white belt, in the sense of sometimes they can be a little challenging to control, because they're so wild and unpredictable. You don't know what they're going to do, while you're still trying to be technical and not accidentally hurt them or take a knee to the face or something like that. So not where it's a struggle where they're going to beat me, more it's I got to figure this out, because they're going nuts right here. So yeah, he definitely has that style where you don't know what he's going to do. Where I agree, when I watch Mika, I know what he's going to do, as he's doing it. I feel the path is very clear to me of what he's trying to do, because it's very similar to what I would do. But then it's like, yeah, Rutolo is what are you guys doing? But it's working great. And I feel like Craig is actually similar too, Craig Jones, in a sense. Not where he's chaotic, but the stuff that he does in his guard is stuff that I don't do. His leg lock entries and stuff like that. He's a very different body type too. But when I watch it, sometimes I'm not sure what is he trying to achieve right now? But then he achieves something. It's okay, that's what he's trying to do. So I guess I need to watch Craig more. But someone like Mika, it's a lot more straightforward of I don't want to say fundamentals, because those are hard to define, but it's more it's just very clear what he's doing. Lots of different styles.
I think that makes it fun though. When you watch, guys like Mika against someone like the Rutolos, that match with Cade, you know it's going to be exciting. You know it's going to be scrappy, but it's kind of I always like to say the Rutolos are you took a black belt's skills and knowledge and put it in a white belt's body, and are just like, hey man, all those weird things that most black belts stop doing over time because you're oh, I'll just be more efficient. They're I don't care about efficiency. And you're oh, interesting choice. I guess that works when you have the cardio that those two kids have. I mean, they're what, like 20 years old? So,
yeah.
I mean, I don't think I could sustain the pace that those guys put on a match for 20 minutes. I think that might actually kill me. So it's fun to watch and see how different people approach problem. Like you said, Craig is kind of similar in that it sometimes, like, I don't know what he's going to do. He just does things. It's, I would say maybe less athletic than the Rutolos, less chaotic for sure. But I like watching grapplers like that because you get to see them create really weird problems for their opponents in real time. And you get to watch usually their opponents have a really hard time figuring it out.
Yeah, I think that plays a lot into success too, where like if you have to figure out the guy where it's like he's such a unique grappler, it's almost like stressful in a way where it's like they're so unpredictable. You don't want to make any like wrong movement because they're going to capitalize so fast because they're so chaotic and they're just going to like dive on things that like normally you think that wouldn't be there, are not available, but they're just so like persistent, almost like a bull just like going right into it. It's like, oh crap, like, yeah, it's just like stressful mentally too, dealing with those kind of guys. Who do you think has like the most unique style out of like all the competitive grapplers out there?
Ooh, that's a tough question. Most unique style. That's hard because like, and this is like not going to be quite an answer to the question. I'm going to talk about something else while I think so I can actually give you a good answer. But what I think is really interesting is you tend to see guys from the same gym start to look kind of similar. Like, a lot of the B team guys have a really similar approach. The new wave guys all look really, really similar when you want, like, obviously they do some different stuff and they have their own unique quirks and stuff. But when you break it down, like you can definitely tell gyms have influenced, like the culture and atmosphere within a gym influences the direction of the athletes. Like a lot of the Autos guys, other than the Rutolos, are really similar. And that even happens like on a smaller local level. Like I tell my students all the time, like I can look at their brackets for local tournaments and be like, all right, your first guy is going to pull guard. They'll be like, how do you know? I'm like, everyone from that gym pulls guard every single match. They can't wrestle for shit. He's going to pull guard. And sure enough, they pull guard. And you can kind of tell what gym people train at by how they roll, but super unique. I don't know if I'd call him like a high level grappler. I mean, he obviously is very high level. I think he's just that, that Dorian kid who won East Coast trials, the young fella at minus 66. I had never seen anyone use the style that he used for that ADCC. And I think that was really unique and really interesting. And I'm going to be shocked if we don't see more people start trying to employ that now.
Yeah, I didn't really see too much of it. I've seen a couple of videos of Dorian, and it seems like he's very wrestling heavy. But how would you describe his style?
So the strategy that he took, so for people who don't know, ADCC has a no points period for the first half of the match. Second half of the match has points involved, and negative points for pulling guard. And then if it's still tied after that, you hit an overtime and you start standing with negative points in play. And then it's just points for 3 minutes. And Dorian's a relatively good high school wrestler. I mean, I don't think he's like nationally ranked or anything, but I think he's like quite a competent high school wrestler. Young, aggressive, has a ton of cardio and energy. And basically what he did is he would take you down or you pull, and he would basically just circle around you super fast with like outside passing, but he was very non-committal. Like he wouldn't come into a guard. He was content to circle and try and dive to north south or dive to side control. And if any time anything ever was not perfect for him, he would just back up and start circling again. And a bunch of his matches would go to the overtime or the points period where you have to stand up with him. And because he felt he was the better wrestler, he just got takedown points and then would go back to doing what he was doing, which was like super loose, non-committal outside passing. And he beat Gianni Grippo that way. He beat Ethan Krellenston that way, who are both like fantastic grapplers, proven success at that division. But it was almost like they just couldn't get a hold of the guy. Like, they couldn't get a grip on him. They couldn't do any of their game that they wanted to play because he just wouldn't engage with them unless it was, you know, him getting perfect side control or something. So I thought that was a really unique style.
Yeah, I find like that style is the most annoying style to deal with. You know, it's like typical like wrestler style. And Nicky Rod is kind of similar in that sense of like when I was doing the breakdown on him, like, yeah, he'll he'll come in, but only enough. And if he can't get anything, he'll back out. And then he'll come back in. He'll back out. And he's like constantly until he can guess what he wants, which is the body lock. And wrestlers are just so much like that. Like, and MMA fighters too, where it's like, you just want to like get a hold of them so we can get going. But you start to try to get them, they start backing out. It's like, okay, now you're coming back in. Okay, now I want to get you. They're back out, you know? So it really kind of, it's like they're not playing the game. Not in a bad way do I mean that, but they're not like playing the game of like, okay, let's like grapple, you know, try to pass my guard while I'm going to try to sweep you. Like, but they have no obligation to do that. So like, I understand, like, it's a very effective strategy, but it's like, you know, almost like in striking, you know, where someone is just pumping the jab out there and kind of moving, you know, they're like striking, they're hitting you, but then they're just, but then they're also like not, they're just staying on the outside basically and just not really making it a real fight where, you know, they're really trying to kill each other, where it's more like they're landing their shots, then they're getting out of distance. And that can be really annoying as a fan watching striking when they do that. But grappling, yeah, still annoying, but not in a bad way. So when I say annoying, I mean like effective. Yeah, like effective almost, you know, like annoying in a good way. But yeah, that's a tough style to deal with for sure. Like what is the best way to deal with that style, do you think?
So I actually, like, after that tournament, I tried to do this for like 2-3 weeks in my gym and just use that style on people and see if I could do it. A couple takeaways. One, holy hell, is that physically exhausting? Like, that's physically and mentally exhausting because you can't engage if you don't have perfect conditions. So you just constantly have to be like thinking about like, when can I come in? When do I have to back away? And like, it's taxing, man. It's, you know, I typically have pretty good cardio for jiu-jitsu. And by the end of those nights, I was like, I'm really tired. I don't know if I could do too many more rounds. Like, so credit to that young kid for having the energy to do that, because I don't have that. But the thing that I found people were doing was almost like, and it's going to sound really counterintuitive, but like giving up something as the bottom player. Like, people were having not a lot of success, especially against Dorian in that tournament. Like, watching his match with Ethan's a good one. Ethan kept trying to get a guard, kept trying to enter onto leg locks, play a closed guard, and Dorian just kept backing away. And I almost think you have to bait him in. You've got to give something to make him think, like, okay, this is a good opportunity. Like, maybe you're really good from bottom side control and you're good at re-guarding or something. You're like, you know what? I'm going to give up the 3 points, take the bottom position, knowing that I now at least have a grip and a connection on this guy, and maybe I can turn it into something. Things like that. Like, I found what a lot of people did for me is they almost like baited me into a half guard, because I like half guard passing. So they just kind of like, oh, look, you've got around half my body here. Enjoy this half guard. Take it. I was a little too willing sometimes to be like, okay, I'll enter half guard. And then you're like, oh shit, I'm stuck here now.
I agree. I think that's exactly the way to deal with that style, is to give a little bit. And, you know, this is one thing I've done for a long time, which is like give people stuff just so like, because I like countering. And in wrestling a lot, I find I don't hand fight a lot because I want them to like get something so like we can get going, because it's so annoying in wrestling, especially when like, you're trying to get some offense going, but they're just so defensive. Like, they just don't want to lose. Like, they don't want to win, but they're not fighting to win. They're fighting just not to lose. And it's just like, let's go, you know? So like, give them a little bit and then, you know, counter them off that. And I've said that on my YouTube channel before. And I think sometimes people get the impression that I'm just making excuses for not being good at hand fighting, but that's not the case. Well, maybe it is, but like, you know, yeah, you give a little and then you can take more than what you gave.
Yeah. There's something to be said for knowing, like, if I leave openings, however small, as long as you're aware that you're leaving the openings, sometimes people will really like, I don't want to say like, but like overcommit towards those openings. And then that leaves chances for you to counter, you know. It's like, I do this a lot from like if I'm on bottom position, like even like a bottom mount, and I like the guy's really good and he's got a good position, sometimes like, hey man, I'll start to maybe give you like a piece of an arm or a piece of something just to try to encourage you to move, and then that gives me opportunities to move as well. It's very hard when positions, like you said, like with hand fighting, it can become so stagnant where we just stand there and we're just, you know, hand fighting and it's boring. And especially if the person in you are like maybe a similar skill at hand fighting, it can really neutralize out. And it's like, maybe I'll let you get a good grip and I'll just try and work off of that and create motion and offense from this slightly disadvantageous position. But like, I got really into, this is a little side tangent, I got really into like college wrestling. Like I think I've watched like every NCAA match this year. Like, I don't know why, I'm really loving it. And I think jiu-jitsu's in trouble if a lot of these guys decide to switch over post wrestling career, just because of how good they are at like hand fighting, getting those ties, getting the takedowns and the approach to that. Like, I mean, we saw Dorian at East Coast Trials, who's a relatively successful high school wrestler. Michael Pixley, again, to bring it back to West Coast Trials, pretty successful Division II wrestler. And they're doing really well with this stuff. Like, Pixley's hand fighting is fantastic. Like, he's really good at it. And I think hand fighting is something in jiu-jitsu that's just not particularly great right now. Like, you know, we kind of talked about like how it can stalemate out. You watch Division I wrestling and these guys are really good at it. And there are guys who, like, you know, even at the highest levels of wrestling, they're winning the hand fight battles. And like, man, they will dominate jiu-jitsu people with the hand fighting if they start coming over to the sport.
Yeah, I think the way to address that is things like ecological approach. Like, it's a lot of live training, working that, you know, using constraints. So we've been doing a lot of grip fighting in the classes, you know, doing ecological. And yeah, definitely that works really good. Again, I said I wouldn't talk about ecological, but like, you know, yeah, that's been working great. And do you find it fun, Mike, or do you find it boring?
I used to absolutely fucking hate wrestling, and now I actually find it fun. And I don't mind when I screw up. I go down, do the push-ups. It's a good exercise.
But we don't do that every time.
No, we don't do that every time. We've only done that a few times, but I enjoy doing that. Even if you'd say not to do it, I still do push-ups. I just enjoy doing it for the workout. But I enjoy wrestling now. I hated it before.
Do you think it's because you're becoming more comfortable?
Yes. Even when you'd use me as a Uki, I'd be terrified. You know, you'd go to do a double leg and I'd cringe because I was afraid I was going to get hurt. But now I know how to land properly, and I know I trust my partners and of course my coach. And I have more confidence to do more wrestling. And now I stand up probably 50% of the times I roll when I would do 0% before.
Yeah. And like, the majority of wrestling, I would say, is in the hand fight. You know, like, once you've won that fight, that's when you go to the other stuff, right? So we're spending so much time in the hand fighting, the grip fighting, and building that skill and also that confidence. Because if you just learn a technique of like, okay, here's a double leg, and then it's like, well, shit, I don't even know how to get in position to be able to actually shoot for that double leg. So it's like, you just don't get experience there. Where like, wrestlers have a ton of experience with hand fighting because it's so important. Whereas like jiu-jitsu, a lot of times people don't even start standing to begin with, so they're not going to develop that skill. And they're never going to have that skill. So doing things like the constraint-led approach is like great for that. And yeah, I also want to say, I just want to clarify, we don't do the push-ups every time, because people gave me shit for that. Like, oh, it's all about skill acquisition. Okay, I understand. But we can mix things up once in a while. We can have some fun, do some push-ups. It's all right. You know, I don't know.
Actually, the other night when I asked if we're going to do push-ups, you said no. I was actually disappointed. I like doing that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, teach their own. And I don't know. It's like, people try to make me feel dumb or stupid or bad, you know, for even suggesting that. And then I started feeling bad. I'm like, damn it, was it a dumb thing? But it's like, no, I think it's all right. You know, time and place, do what you want. But yeah, I think that's like one way, because I think that stuff like that's going to make people's wrestling in jiu-jitsu better just in general. Like, I think all schools need to implement more live training and spending time doing those kind of like, I don't want to say boring, because it's not boring, but those like more monotonous type of things. Like, hand fighting isn't super exciting, but it's super important.
No, Mike.
Oh, I was just going to say, I feel like I could enter a tournament more confidently now than I could before.
Yeah.
That's all I was going to say. Sorry, Joey.
No, I was going to say, like, at our gym, like, we will play specific games around the hand fight, like, where the goal is just to get two dominant grips with inside position on both grips. So like, if I have my collar tie, I need the inside tie, bicep tie, I need to be inside. Other partners just trying to get two inside grips and fighting back and forth. And we'll do that game.
That's exactly what we do.
Yeah. And it's crazy how if you do that even like twice a week for a month, how quickly people develop these hand fighting skills. Like hand fighting is not a particularly complex task. It's not super complex. And I think there's a lot of people who like to make it sound way, you know, more difficult than it really is. But like, once you understand what the hands are doing with like dominant positions and how that relates to like how you can shoot for takedowns, how you can manipulate your partner, it's really not super complex. It's just the skills of like actually doing it. There's not a lot of like pretty much anyone can hand fight. Like I actually think you could take someone who's never grappled off the street and start a stand up match and basically just explain what they're trying to do with their hands. And like anyone can do it. It's not physically demanding. It's not super difficult. Like a barambolo, you would have a really hard time getting like a 60-year-old grandma who's never trained before to do a barambolo, but you could definitely get that same person to get dominant hand position in stand up. Like it's not hard. So it's just doing it. The other big thing I want to say that like I take away from watching like wrestling is the way they use their head. That's something I think all like a lot of jiu-jitsu guys need to work on too, is not just hand fighting, but like head positioning, standing and on the ground. Like, I know we've talked about this a lot. You've talked about it. You've got videos on it, but like, guys, use your head. Like dominant head position changes positions. Like if you have, you know, we'll say again, I'll just go with standing, but like if you have an underhook on me, but I have a dominant head position, I'm winning that position. Like your underhook is meaningless. My head position nullifies it and gives me more options. Like I think a lot of people get lazy or like, I don't know. Maybe there's a lot of jiu-jitsu people who are like, oh, I don't want to like fight with my head and put my head into these positions. It's like, no, you got to do it, man. It makes such a difference.
Yeah. That's one of the games we play. Like we do the one that you mentioned where you're looking for inside ties. And we also do one where one person starts off with inside ties and head position. And then the other person can win by getting head position for themselves or disengaging. So like they were doing it and oftentimes they would just go 50-50. They'd let each other get head position on each other. But I'm like, no, you just lost the game because that was the rule. That was the objective, is like, don't let them get head position on you. So like, then I like brought everyone back together and I showed them an example. I'm like, guys, like, no, don't let this 50-50 head position happen. Like you have, like, make sure you keep an angle the whole time. And I showed them, you know, moving with, like, as they're trying to get the head position, I'm moving and keeping an angle. And then after I mentioned that, like it, like everyone changed. Everyone was like way more focused on head position. So like, yeah, that's a really good drill we did. And then also getting the collar ties or the inside ties and combining those two, people are really understanding way more of like what to do. Another one we do too is like two on one grips. So like, it's continuous. You're trying to get 2-on-1 on them. They're trying to get 2-on-1 on you, like on their arms. So you're trying to get two grips on their arm. And that's working out great too. And where they also need to keep head position in mind, because if you have 2-on-1 grip, but they have head position, then it's like, well, good luck trying to get stuff, you know, because they're going to use their head to defend. Is there any other like wrestling drills or grip fighting wrestling drills that maybe I haven't thought of that you do?
No, that's like, I don't run our wrestling classes. We have a wrestling coach for that. He's really good, so he comes up with a lot of this kinds of stuff. But it'll be a lot of that. Or like sometimes we'll do like underhook games. Like instead of like fighting for ties, sometimes we'll fight for underhooks and stuff. But mostly it's just about like, can you get dominant grips? And then we'll usually add on pieces of the game after, like, can we use this dominant grip to, now I'm trying to like, this is actually a game that our kids coach does for the kids class, but and he gets like little like hula hoops for them. But the goal is to pull one of your partner's feet or push one of your partner's feet outside of the hula hoop. And basically what you're doing is they're just getting these dominant grips and then using it to push and pull and make your partner step. Because like, anyone who's done a lot of wrestling knows if both people are static, it's really hard to shoot a takedown. Usually you want to get these things when people are moving. And a big part of that is like, well, how do I move a guy? How do I use these grips to pull or push? Or how do I manipulate people side to side, circle with them? So that's a fun little game we'll sometimes play. You can do it like if you have a mat, like I know you have like the squares, like the tatami style mats. Like you can be like, hey guys, this is your square. You're just trying to push or pull your partner out of their square.
Yeah, we do that sometimes, stuff like that. I feel like people never listen of like understanding like this is the square, like stay in your freaking square, you know, like they're blue. So, you know, they're not like differentiated of like, but you can still look and see. And yeah, sometimes I get frustrated with that. It's like, guys, like you're out of the square, like listen to my freaking instruction. But yeah, that's, I could rant forever about stuff people don't listen. Using the hula hoop, is that considered differential learning? Do I understand correctly?
Yeah, kind of. Again, like that's not something I would maybe necessarily do with the adults. But I think it's a really good way. Like for children, you want to give them very tangible goals for the games. So like, you know, it's still environmental. I'm still just causing the reaction with them. I'm just, the hula hoop's really just there to give them like a quick, like a clear visual indicator that you have stepped or not stepped outside of the space that you were given. Cause like you said, with the mats, like you, it's shocking how often you push people out of the mat and you're like, you realize you're three steps outside of your mat right now. And they're like, oh, didn't realize. I'm like, well, the hula hoop tells you, cause you know, right away when you stepped outside, like it's very visual. So it's more of just like a cue.
Yeah. And plus you can do some hula hooping after, have some fun.
I don't know how to hula hoop.
Yeah. I'm not very good at it either, but the more
hard,
we do
man.
It is very hard. It is. Yeah. I was going to ask you too about this, not a drill we do, but like, well, I guess depending on how you define it. So we would do, we were doing like those games and stuff like that, but then we're also doing things where, spending a little bit of time on where like you have inside ties and then your partner is pushing into you. And then when you're ready, you can shoot for whatever you want. So I'll give like, if it's beginners, I'll say just shoot for a double, you know, just keep it really easy. But then everyone else, they can do what they want. You can do a snap down, you can go single, you can go single, you can go high crotch, you can go, it's the body lock, but all these takedowns are easier to do when someone's pushing into you. Right. So like, I feel like that's like a good thing to do, to develop that like confidence, awareness and whatnot in like a low stress environment. So it's not completely, no resistance because they are pushing into you. It's not static, but it's also, they're not resisting trying to stop you. So like, I know, I don't want to go like, you know, a debate like we had before, but do you think something like that is useful or does that go against what you consider like, good for the ecological approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has value. I think you could maybe like change the constraints slightly to make it more optimal, but I think that's good. Like, the big thing for me is like, and I'm kind of learning this, and some of the eco guys are going to fucking hate me for this because I think I'm going to say something, but the big thing for me is it has to be resistance and not scripted. So like the, like my problem with static drilling is it's like this guy on bottom is going to do an arm bar and you're not going to resist him at all. And I know how this ends. He does an arm bar and it's going to look picture perfect because it's impossible not to when the person's literally not moving. With this way, like the guy's pushing into you. If you take a shitty shot, you're just going to get run over. Like it's not going to work. The shot still does have to be good. You still have to, you know, arms have to come out of the way. You have to have the inside. You have to have the setup for your shot or the guy's just going to run you off the mat. Like, it's not necessarily scripted in that way. Like, yes, you're telling them like you're going for a shot, but you're not telling them specifically like each individual mechanic of the shot, like drop your knee halfway, come underneath. It's like, hey, however you want to get under this guy who's ramming into you to get to the shot you need to take or the snap down you need to take, like you're still getting that information from the environment. So I think stuff like that's fine. I really think, some people get a little too like caught up on like things have to be 100% perfect. Like they have to meet the criteria for this learning methodology 100% perfect or they're absolutely useless. And that's just not true. Like there's value in anything that's closely approximates. Like if a person's pushing into you and you're telling them to shoot, that person's learning. They're getting information from that. Like you can definitely like add constraints to that to make it maybe like a little better, or like you could build off it with like a second step to the game to like maybe make the learning a little bit more like I want to say like relatable or a little more diverse, but ultimately that's a really good game to play.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you saying that, and that's pretty much what we do. So like that's like building the confidence and like understanding of like, okay, I can do this, I can do that. And when then we go into actual resistance game where like you'll have those collar ties or those ties. And now you're actually trying to get like, they're trying to stop you. But I feel like doing it first without resistance, but they are pushing into you. It's just great for just confidence. Even myself, like, I feel like just even showing it and doing it a bit, like, it makes me shooting for when I am live, it makes me feel like more confident. Okay, yeah. And I'm an experienced grappler, so I think it's really good for people that are non-experienced especially. But one thing, Joey, I wanted to ask you too, like, I heard you say perfect like 3 times this podcast, and this is something I'm arguing with the people on Discord, because they think that a perfect technique doesn't exist. But in the way I view things is like, there's a perfect way to do basically every technique, but like, you're striving towards perfect and you're not always going to get there. And the closer to perfect you get, the more successful it's going to be. But like, you can't always get it perfect, but you know, that's ideal. But like, do you think perfect exists or not?
I mean, that's, it really depends on how you're going to define perfect. I mean, I don't define perfect for a technique on how it looks or like the visual like aspects of the technique. What I would define a perfect technique is, did it meet all of the criteria it needed to meet to accomplish the goal? So like, I have a really like, I'm going to give away my secrets on the podcast. I have a really janky single leg. Like, it's not great. Part of that comes from having one functional shoulder and a knee that doesn't work right. Physically, my body just doesn't move in the way that certain people move. I have a hard time doing certain things. So my single leg looks kind of janky, but I'm able to get most people I shoot my single leg on down. It has a really high percentage. It doesn't look the way, you know, an NCAA wrestler is going to look with their single leg, but it's effective because it still meets the same criteria. So in my mind, that's perfect. It works. I took my body, I met the base criteria, I made it work. I do this for a lot of my students. Like, maybe their side control escape doesn't look the way you would see it shown in like Gracie magazine, where it's like this beautiful like bridge and shrimp, the knee comes all the way through. They've got some weird way they make it work. Did it work? Did you get out of side control? And can you replicate that on opponents of varying skill and size? If the answer is yes, then that's perfect technique. It works. It does exactly what you need it to do. Like, a good example, like, and people laugh at me when I say this, is the buggy choke. Does the buggy choke accomplish what it needs to accomplish? I'm trying to submit this guy with a choke. Does it look great? No, it looks stupid. Should it work? Probably not. It's from a weird position. It's from, a pin. Like, this thing shouldn't work. It shouldn't make sense, but it accomplishes the goal. So, hey, why not?
That's exactly what I think, where like, it's not so much like how it doesn't have to be exactly like this, like every time, but like, you need to meet the criteria, and there's specific criteria that needs to be met. There's different ways of doing that. So like, I don't know. Cause they're like, oh, a tap's a tap. But I don't agree with that, because I think you get false positives of like tapping people out that are just, you know, they want to save their neck from like getting broken, but they're not really getting choked. Right. So like, I don't know. That's something that like, yeah, we've been arguing a lot about over there. They kind of laugh at me, cause I think that perfect exists, but they don't think perfect exists. So,
Like, just to build off that, I think one thing that a lot of people fail to consider, and I know you're considering because I've rolled with you and I've seen you teach, and I know you feel this way, is a tap is a tap, but not all taps are able to be replicated. And that to me is what matters. Like, there's a way you have to do things. Like, I know we've talked a lot about arm triangles. Like, you might be able to tap some people without a good bite on your arm triangle just by having the pressure, and maybe they're not strong. Maybe you get like a certain angle and you get a certain pressure, someone's weak in a certain way, and you can get that tap. That's not going to be able to be replicated on everybody. So that's not a good choke. Yes, you got your tap, but you're doing it in a way that's, like you said, like a false positive. Like, yeah, this worked on a guy. Maybe it worked on the day one white belt. That doesn't mean it works, man. So this is when I say to my students, like, I don't care how it looks. I care that it accomplishes the goals, but not just on one person. I care that you can accomplish the goal on a variety of size and skill. Because if you can, you know, maybe your arm triangle, someone's got a strange way they do it, but they can tap everybody from white through black, featherweight through heavyweight. It's impossible to argue that that's not an effective technique now. If it works on people of varying skill and size, and, you know, it works consistently, that's an effective technique. And I think, a lot of people who are like, oh, there's no perfect way. Like, a tap is a tap. It's like, yes, but is this tap something you can do on more than one person? Like, I've got some weird stuff that, like, you know, you give me a not so great blue belt or, like, you know, some of the more fun guys in my gym, and I can hit them with some pretty stylish stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I tapped them with this, but this is like the silliest shit that's absolutely never going to work for me in a black belt level tournament. It's fun to do. It's cool to have, but I wouldn't say that, like, oh yeah, it's super effective. Like, no, this is just a weird niche thing that you can have that you can do on someone you're way better than because they don't have the skills to stop it.